A lot can happen in the next 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Treat mom to healthy, glowing skin with Osea's limited edition skincare sets. Osea has been making clean, seaweed-infused products for nearly 30 years. Their Golden Glow body set includes 3 clinically proven bestsellers for smooth, glowing skin, while the Glow and Go facial set provides spa-level results at home. Both sets come in giftable boxes with savings up to $48 and free shipping for a limited time. For 10% off your first order site-wide, go to oseamalibu.com and use code MOM.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to Hidden Histories. So today I spoke to Emily Brand. Emily is an author, historian, and genealogist specializing in the 18th century, especially the trials and tribulations of romantic relationships in England. Her most recent book, The Fall of the House of Byron, Scandal and Seduction in Georgian England, is a real page-turner. It's been selected as the BBC Radio 4 Book of the Week and described as a ravishing family saga. She talks to me all about Lord Byron and his scandalous family that came before him. I hope you enjoy the podcast. Hi, Emily Brand. Welcome to Hidden Histories.
Hello, thank you.
And congratulations on the publication of your fantastic new book.
Thanks so much. It's an odd time, but staying positive.
Yeah, exactly. And actually, hopefully, people actually have more time to read it. And so... So they can fill their lockdown with salacious rumour, gossip and stories about Byron.
There's plenty of that, yes.
So I was just saying on the phone to you just now, I don't really know anything about Lord Byron. And actually, it's one of those names you think, gosh, I must know so much. It's just sort of comes, I suppose it's like osmosis. It sort of flows into the womb, doesn't it? But actually, thinking about it, I know very, very little. So this is not just about Byron himself. This is about 3 generations of Byron family. Is that right?
Yes, just thought I might as well make it difficult for myself and just have a whole family saga going on, basically. Yeah, so it's not... the poet is sort of ever-present throughout the book. He sort of bookends it, really. We begin with him and we end with him, but the main bulk of the story is really discovering how he came to be in that situation, why he inherited his title when he was just 10, because it wasn't a clear line to him. And it's all the context of the background, going through the 18th century and what the Byrons were up to during that time, and charting really their sort of fall, if you like, from the beginning of the century to the end of the century and then ending. So it's a prequel, basically. It's a prequel to the poet and sort of exploring slightly how he was impacted as well and influenced by those ancestors who are generally pretty much forgotten nowadays. So I think it does shine a bit of a light on the poet's mentality as well.
So it's an absolutely brilliant subject. And you're right. I mean, it must be the context of his upbringing and his life and his family that influenced his character that people know so well. Okay, so starting from the beginning, who were the Byrons?
So, I mean, everyone obviously will think of the poet. So this sort of this Regency era rake and poet and libertine, if you like. What my book does, as I've said, it sort of begins and ends with him, but we sort of shift backwards to his grandparents' generation, really, which are kicking off really at the beginning of the 18th century. But obviously they've been around, the family, the Byrons themselves have been around in England for, I think it's a good 750 years before the poet. You know, they've come over with William the Conqueror, they've established themselves gradually, sort of wheedling into the favour of various monarchs and being elevated eventually to the peerage in the 17th century. So it's a sort of a gradual upward move for them until the 18th century, when they all get a bit entitled and showy-offy, and it doesn't go particularly well for them, which is how it ends with the poet inheriting Newstead Abbey, which is the family seat in Nottinghamshire. But by that time, it's a virtual ruin because the fortune's been lost and the upkeep can't be afforded anymore. So yeah, they've been around for a long time and it sort of all goes wrong in the 18th century, I would say.
Okay, so they became peers in the 17th century. Do you think that that went hand in hand with the Restoration and the salacious court of Charles II and that rise of the rake, so to speak?
Well, they initially were sort of being rewarded for their loyalty during the Civil War, one particular, the first Sir John, the first Baron Byron. And then obviously they sort of fall off the radar during the Cromwellian era, but then certainly in the Restoration they sort of come back with a vengeance, and they definitely embrace this Restoration enthusiasm for pleasure and all this. And there's a lovely quote, and I'm probably going to butcher it, in the 1670s the future third lord is sort of having a bit of a poetry competition with one of his friends, and his friend really flatters him in a verse. It's something like, "Is it not enough the Byrons all excel as much in loving as in fighting well?" So at the end, sort of towards the mid to the end of the 17th century, there's also this apparent slightly jocular reputation for being awesome in bed and awesome on the battlefield as well. So I really loved finding that one. But I think they probably were sort of coming into their own in that era, definitely.
Okay, so the book begins in the 18th century with the fifth Baron Byron. Who was he and what was his position within society?
So the fifth Baron is the poet's grandfather's brother. In the book, there is a family tree, so it will be easier to follow that. So the poet's great uncle, and he's born in 1722. And he becomes the fifth Lord in 1736. So he's about 13 or 14. And he sort of comes into this great fortune. You know, it's not wild wealth, but it's very steady, very stable. He's got a beautiful house that the, you know, society is in huge admiration of Newstead Abbey for its art collection and for its sort of amazing aesthetic as well. And it's him really who fritters everything away, I think, possibly coming into it too young and being basically allowed to do what he wanted from such a young age isn't going to do anyone any good. He seems to have been basically just a very swaggering, entitled sort of a chap, falling into very bad company as a young man, and then not getting everything on a silver platter in sort of military terms. He sort of keeps trying to go for shots at glory in the Navy and then in the Army, but ends up scuttling off home before being able to achieve anything. And people, I think, made a bit of fun of him, and this eventually turned him into a bit of an embittered, dreadful sort of man. So basically he goes through his life sort of on the back foot, really, sort of looking spitefully at people. And the event that he's most famous for comes in his 40s. It's in 1765. And he's basically at a Nottinghamshire club meeting in London. There's a lot of claret flowing and sort of genial arguments going on about who's got the best estate and who can hunt best and all this. And he ends up basically getting into a very petty dispute with someone that he's known all his life, and they've been constantly falling in and out of arguments, and he ends up stabbing him and killing him. So when this comes out the next morning, sort of the papers are full of it, the society gossip is full of it, and he ends up being dragged basically to the Tower of London and being subjected to this trial for murder, which is his most notorious moment for sure.
Oh, wow. So Byron, as in the poet Byron, his ancestor was actually tried for murder.
Yes.
What was the outcome of that? Was he imprisoned?
He was imprisoned in the Tower. But, well, his first reaction was to run off to France, which I think didn't do him any good in sort of the public eye. But then he, a couple of weeks later, comes back. He ends up being put in the Tower of London for a couple of months. Fortunately for him, his uncle was the constable of the Tower, so everything was made extremely comfortable for him. I don't think he had too much of a problem with being there anyway.
It's handy.
No, exactly. But yes, basically he ends up in the middle of April 1765 being tried for murder at the House of Lords. It doesn't go on for as long as everyone expects, but it's absolutely rammed with the sort of great and good of society. Some royals show up, some people come over from France to see what's going on, because obviously if he gets found guilty, he'd be hanged. But fortunately for him, I think everybody except two get him charged for manslaughter rather than murder, and then the other two completely acquit him of everything. So he basically just pays a bit of a fine and then jumps in his sedan chair and goes home and then goes on holiday. So it all works out really fine for him in the end. He just gets a bit of notoriety under his belt as well.
Okay, so he was tried for murder and acquitted. What happened to him afterwards, and who followed him? Who then took the Byron name forward?
So yes, it's an odd one actually, because William, who I've just been speaking about, is the fifth Lord. He goes on forever. Obviously, the awful ones outlive everybody. So he outlives both of his sons and his grandson, and his brother, who is the poet's grandfather, and that's John Byron, who's known to history as Foulweather Jack. And he outlives Foulweather Jack's son, who's known as Mad Jack. So the title goes from this embittered old killer, essentially. I don't want to call him a murderer, but he did kill someone, straight down to this 10-year-old great nephew who he'd never met and had no wish to get to know either. So in terms of the title, it goes straight from William to the future poet. But the book traces, really, it's the story of this William the Fifth Baron and his younger brother, Foulweather Jack, who's the poet's grandfather, and their elder sister, Isabella. And all three of them sort of go through life with their various scandals and adventures and terrible deeds that they've done. So it really follows the three of them from birth till death.
And so, okay, so let's talk about Foulweather Jack. Where does that name come from?
Well, one thing that I was really keen to do in researching this book is to try and uncover, if possible, where all these sort of amazing myths about this family come from. Because when we read biographies of the poet, the first few pages tend to be a really condensed, myth-laden version of these people. Obviously, they're setting the background for the poet's family history and childhood and all of that. And it's full of all these amazing names. So William is known as the Wicked Lord Byron, John is known as Foulweather Jack, and then the poet's father is known as Mad Jack. And the only one of those nicknames that I was able to actually find in their own lifetime was Foulweather Jack. And I was amazed and delighted to be able to do that, because I was just assuming it was all sort of posthumous, you know, labelling. So his nickname's Foulweather Jack. I'm going to refer to him as John because that's what he calls himself in his correspondence. But he basically, while his brother takes up the title, he joins the Navy and has this amazing Navy career, which starts off with a shipwreck in just off the coast of Chile, and this amazing 5-year survival story as he's trying to make his way back to England from Chile, basically. So his sort of career begins with this tempestuous storm and shipwreck. And then as he does eventually get home, as he goes through his career, he picks up this reputation, basically, for wherever he goes, he's followed by storms, and that it's thwarting him at every turn. I don't think that's quite true, but certainly by the time of the American Revolutionary War, John is sort of sent into that as an admiral, charged with sorting it all out on the seas, basically. And in this mission, certainly within weeks of leaving England, his squadron is totally scattered. Then when he makes it up to America again, every single time he sort of spies the enemy, Mother Nature comes in and shoves him off somewhere else or sinks his ships or whatever. So this nickname, Foulweather Jack, certainly does date from the 1778-79 time when he was involved in the American Revolution. And I found it in the one of the London papers, basically saying that his sailors call him Foulweather Jack because he's so thwarted by storms wherever he goes.
Okay, so this is during the period of, was it the American Revolution and the Seven Years War?
He's definitely gets involved in both of those. The Seven Years War was slightly earlier But he gets stuck into that one as well.
Okay, okay. And what was it like to research one of the Byron women? So you mentioned Isabella, who was the wicked Lord Byron, or William V Baron's sister. Does she have the sort of similar characteristics, or was she more of a surprising, different sort of character?
Yeah, I really loved being able to tell the stories of the story of Isabella, also of the poet's grandmother, Sophia. Obviously, the women have totally dropped from the sort of myths, and also as a result from sort of the historical record a bit. Isabella herself, I think, was probably my favourite of the lot of them. The sort of character traits that I found in her were very much... She was in love with love, basically. So she's left a lot of letters behind to some of her friends, to her daughters, and my favourite was to her second husband, during the time of their sort of courtship and their marriage, and then their eventual sort of marital breakdown and separation. So it was all quite sad. But the way that she writes is just so spirited and romantic, and she was desperate to sort of go to Europe and travel like her brothers had, and she was constantly whinging about not being able to do the things the men could because it was unseemly, basically, sort of to go up the mountains on horseback and all this sort of thing. So she was a really fascinating and lively female character that I think you don't get all that often, unless they've been sort of transmuted into some perfect feisty heroine, which she certainly wasn't. She had her flaws as well.
Yeah, she sounds almost like a character from fiction rather than an actual living, breathing woman within this period, especially within the context of two quite powerful male figures around her.
Mm, definitely. I think she was the oldest, and I think she was a bit probably spoilt in the same way that her brother William was. And her mother was very young, and sort of her father wasn't really around, and you know, from the age of about 15. So I think she was probably indulged a little bit in these ideas of not so much female duty, but finding her own passions and being able to indulge her own creative talents and all of this. But yeah, I don't want to paint her as a sort of this sort of ideal feisty heroine, because she absolutely wasn't. She was sort of a dreadful woman at times as well. But I think for me, that sort of more three-dimensional character made me like her all the more.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's interesting because we're looking at the, you know, you've got the rakish character of William, the fifth Baron, and then the adventurer in Foul Weather Jack, and then you have the romantic in Isabella. It's interesting how all three of those components sort of tie into the personification of Byron as well, of the poet.
Absolutely.
So his father was dubbed very kindly Mad Jack. Was he mad?
Well, the story of that one is comes about, I think it's in the 1820s is the first time that's put in print. So I'm very loath to sort of say. Jack himself died in 1791. So he's well dead by the time this nickname starts doing the rounds. I think what's for certain is that he wasn't a very nice person. I wouldn't say he was this. I've not seen any indication that he had any madness or mental illness or anything like this, which sort of the nickname suggests. But he was hugely selfish and entitled and out for himself at all times, really. So while one thing I was thinking that I might be able to do at the beginning of this project was rehabilitate some of these characters a bit, but there was no way of doing that with Jack, for sure. There's great sources showing that he was a very handsome man and evidently could be very charming, getting all these women into bed, including people far above his rank and, you know, anything that he could have hoped for, really. He did manage it. So there's obviously there some parallels with his son, the poet, as well. But yeah, in terms of money and rinsing everyone he could, and then just sort of leaving all of his responsibilities behind at the first moment to sort of run off to France, he did all of those very eagerly.
What do you think it was about Georgian England or London that enabled these characters to become such kind of parodies of themselves.
I suppose for us looking back, it's so much easier for us to pick up these things because of the sort of blossoming of print culture in the 18th century. And this is one of the reasons that I love the era so much, is just that the material for it is so rich, and gossiping as well. You know, the sort of renown can be made in newspaper gossip columns. And I think that in different ways, the people in, well, most of the people in the Byron family sort of were influenced or shaped by this. So for Jack, the poet's father, his early scandalous affair with a married Lady Carmarthen, he really exploded onto the public scene with that. And it was very much all about, you know, the intimacies of their bedroom activities being laid bare. And that's just not something you find so much in earlier eras, I think. So maybe it's just more that we're more able to eavesdrop really from the material that's left. But also, you know, the era itself is still quite renowned for just being terribly bawdy and having that sort of sense of humour and all these sort of debauchers being fair game and very visible wherever you went. So it's probably a combination of those.
Yeah, it's the age of satire, isn't it? And I think we've talked in the past, actually, I think, about some of the cartoons that are still available that people can see of these sort of mock King George or the Prince Regent, all of these different characters who are just portrayed, or, you know, the characters like Mad Jack being portrayed so rudely. And it's amazing that these could go to print. It was kind of, I suppose, would you say that something like The Private Eye is today the nearest you would get to something like that? Or...
I would say so. There was fairly free license for these things at that time, even, as you say, with the royals. And it was a way also to elevate fairly lowly people up to this sort of status of celebrity as well. But yeah, I think it's really fascinating. It's obviously something that begins to be suppressed in the very end of the Georgian era. Yeah, it's much easier to sort of investigate during this era.
And Mad Jack, so he, as you said, he managed to seduce many women. Who did he finally marry and therefore became the mother of the poet Byron? So he finally married. Who was that? What was she like?
So his actually, just to zip back a little bit, he was married twice, and his first marriage was with this Lady Carmarthen, who he basically started sleeping with, and then her husband obviously took offence to this and began divorce proceedings immediately. And very shortly afterwards, Jack married her, and they had three children together, only one of whom did survive, and that was Augusta, who's famous for being the poet's half-sister, basically. And then after a bit of a gap, sort of gallivanting about Europe, trying to figure out how to pay his debts now that he didn't have a rich wife to rely on, he comes back to England, comes to Bath, and there he finds a teenage Scottish heiress called Catherine Gordon. And they have what must have been a very whirlwind romance, and they marry in May of, maybe just weeks after he's arrived in Bath in 1785. So he's basically, don't want to say tricked her, but he's definitely gone after her for a fortune. She's very starry-eyed about it at first, but then almost immediately as they go back to her estate in Scotland, he just starts running through her money, and it becomes very clear that was what he was after in the first place. And the only child that they have together is George. By the time he's born in 1788, they're not on good terms, his parents, and they remain not on good terms until Jack basically leaves the country to escape his debts and dies about a year afterwards.
Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact, you can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states.
UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
So that then leaves his young wife and the poet Byron, Lord Byron.
Yeah, yeah. Well, he's so the son is 3.5 at that point, I think. So he's not even quite in the running to be the next lord yet. So it's quite a thing to think that if Jack hadn't gone off and died, it would have been him who was the next Lord Byron. I think he would have been the worst lord that there had ever been, but unfortunately for him, he died in France long before his uncle, the wicked lord, did.
So at what point then does the young Byron inherit this brilliantly described decrepit sort of familial home, Newstead Abbey?
So the person who is in line to inherit for almost until the end of the fifth lord's life is his grandson, and that's William John Byron. He isn't on very good terms with his grandson. He's basically waiting until he turns 21 so that they can resettle and start selling things off so that debts can be made up. What the grandson does is heads off to war and gets himself killed in 1794. So it's in 1794 that basically the fifth lord's family line is extinguished and it heads to who will be the poet. William himself doesn't bother to even find out who's coming next after him because it doesn't benefit him in any way. So basically it's in 1798 that the young poet inherits at the age of 10, and he comes down from Scotland to this stately ruin in Nottinghamshire with his mum to have a look at what on earth it is he's just inherited and to try and figure out how his life would be changed, really. So it's quite unexpected. Until 4 years before he inherits, they didn't expect him to.
So do you think, what do you think made the poet Byron so scandalous? And especially in his early life, how did his reputation, do you think it was in his action, or do you think that his family name preceded it?
I certainly think that he drew a lot of inspiration and a lot of his, well, he spent a lot of his formative years learning about his ancestors and sort of imbibing their stories and finding his place in the world through them, I think. There are some scholars who have sort of pointed to very specific genetic traits that he supposedly inherited from them, so sort of a tendency towards mental instability or a violent temper. I'm not so sure about that level myself, but the poet himself certainly did, and I think that that has to have affected his behaviour and how he sort of went about this colourful life with the sort of baggage of these ancestors behind him. So I think there has to some extent, it has to have informed his adventures. I think his seeking for adventure, certainly. He was a huge admirer of his granddad and his sort of shipwreck feats of daring and all of this business. And he knew as well about his great uncle's duel and one of his school friends' comments about how Byron had always accustomed to associating the Byron name with dueling and violence and all of this. So he probably saw it as a way to, a bit of an excuse for bad behaviour in himself by saying, oh, you know, it's in the blood, so...
Yeah, yeah. It premeditates his further, his future actions in a way. And do you think that he did that in part to differentiate himself from his contemporaries? Or do you think that it was more of a personal way of fostering this tortured poet persona?
I think... I mean, for the most part, he kind of just did what he wanted. And that is a very human thing, isn't it? Throughout history, I think he just, if he wanted to go off travelling and sleep with who he wanted to sleep with, he was quite happy to just stand up for himself and do that. So I'm not sure. He certainly enjoyed his reputation and he fed into his own mythologies quite gleefully.
Was he particularly popular and known and achieved notoriety in his own time for his actions, or was that more of a posthumous thing?
The poet himself?
Yeah.
Oh, he was very much the sort of, people often call him the rock star of his day, and he definitely loved that. Obviously, towards the end, he left England for good in 1816 when sort of for various reasons, but scandals were whipping up around him and his wife was sort of casting aspersions on his good character, and he, you know, had been having an incestuous affair with his half-sister as well, and I think that probably there were whisperings about that. Also, he just wasn't able to indulge the sort of social and sexual life that he wanted to in English society and wanted to leave. So towards the end of his life there, it was definitely towards the notoriety and scandal end rather than the sort of fame and glory.
His sister Augusta, his half-sister, were they, so you say they had this incestuous relationship, were they familiar with each other prior to that, or was that something that emerged as they met later on?
Yeah, they didn't grow up together, and I think they sort of met not very long after he'd first inherited, so when he'd come down to England, very briefly they met. She was, what was she, maybe 4 years older than he was, I think. And then they had a bit of a break and sort of corresponded with each other. And then a few years later, I think he was in his late teens, they met again and sort of struck up this proper friendship and started fostering this proper relationship with each other, which obviously went in a very strange direction eventually. But yeah, so it's I think that was part of his... not excuse is the wrong word, but you know, he would sort of say, you know, we didn't know each other from children, we weren't brought up together, so it's different kind of thing.
Yeah. I mean, in what was about to become a very evangelical, very severe and stern period, something like that must have been quite shocking to people, especially as if he was a celebrity type figure. How was that sort of thing in Byron's, his, not only that, his affairs and his scandalous nature, how was that put to print and how did people hear about it?
Well, with the affair with Augusta specifically, that's actually something that's only really been verified probably relatively recently, and it's sort of been projected, I would say, a little bit onto sources of the time in that, well, I could be wrong, but I don't know of any specific, you know, newspaper articles of the time saying, oh, that rascal Lord Byron and his sister having a child together, which is essentially probably what did happen. So for that in particular, it's been sort of dredged up from correspondence by later scholars. For the scandals in general, I think he was just a constant, ever-present name in newspaper records and in people's diaries and people sort of sending him their fan mail, even though he'd supposedly done all these terrible things. So he just really was very much a sort of celebrity of his time.
So this book is really... it's a really fascinating, complex and thrilling family tree. And that's goes hand in hand is in, with your experience, because you're a genealogist as well as a writer, is that, and that's right. How did you find researching this in comparison to sort of general day-to-day genealogy work that you do? Was there a lot more material? Did you find that you had to sift through a lot of narrative and hyperbole to actually get to the truth? Or did you find that actually stripped down, it was really not too dissimilar?
It was easier for me than most, simply because, you know, there is academic work on this. Not since the 70s, really, but there's one amazing 1,000-year-plus genealogical study of the entire family by a woman called Violet Walker back from the 70s. So having this as a sort of Bible to even start off with, you know, only a couple of chapters really applied to what I was doing that I wanted to flesh out and really focus on. But there was a really good, you know, standing on the shoulders of giants sort of thing there. It's an amazing starting point. So when I'm doing my usual genealogy projects for clients, it tends to be a load of farmers in Lincolnshire that I'm sort of tracing and trying to find them in the records and starting from nothing. So obviously that was an amazing starting point for me. Also, on digging into the archives, and I did find a lot of source material that hasn't been published before in terms of personal correspondence and journals and sort of one really charming little teenage, oh, I think she's about 13, a 13-year-old girl's little diary who was a neighbour of the Byrons, and she was constantly getting very excited about nipping round and being given a present by Lady Byron and seeing the boats on the lake and all of this sort of thing. And because this was upper class, it was just that sort of source was obviously so much more likely to survive and exist, and really allowed me to paint a much livelier picture, I think, of the characters from their own words and also from those just sort of, you know, knocking about with them as well.
And you have a remarkable talent for painting very lively pictures, because I love all of your tweets and your Instagram posts. You just managed to find these little nuggets of just absolute gold, and it just brings so much life to your characters and to the century that you work on.
Well, thank you.
So if somebody wants to explore more of this in the flesh, I know we're obviously not able to do much at the moment, but something I really like to do with this podcast is to encourage people to get out and go and see historical sites, go and immerse themselves within the history that they now know about.
Yeah.
Where would you suggest that people could go to in relation to Byron and his family history?
Yes, for the to-do list when we're allowed out, I would say the number one, if people haven't been before, is definitely Newstead Abbey, which is just outside of Nottingham, and that's the ancestral family seat. It was in the family since the time of Henry VIII until the poet ended up having to sell it. And it's just a sort of gorgeous monument now to the family and to the owners who came after and how they've sort of renovated it. It's a gorgeous museum, open to the public, and the grounds are free as well, I think, as well. So definitely recommend that one, sort of number one on the pilgrimage. For characters from this book, Castle Howard as well was where Isabella, the poet's great aunt, married to become mistress of Castle Howard. And I've only managed to get there myself to get into the archive for a few days, and then just sort of was able to run around in the gardens and quickly take pictures, and then it was closed and I had to leave. So I need to go back to that one myself, but it's this amazing...
It's also got a really good playground.
Ah, does it? Okay.
Yeah.
That's good to know. That's good to know as well. But
For adults oh, too.
Nice.
not just for kids.
So yeah, that's another sort of early 18th century stately home to go to. Obviously, I will always encourage people to get into archives if they are able and interested to sort of look at the original materials. In the book, there's just a very long list of the sort of archives that I went to. British Library was great. National Archives was great. And actually, one place that I found by accident and fell in love with was the Hill Garden and Pergola on Hampstead Heath. And I was looking for the last London villa owned by William, the fifth Lord Byron, And I was just thinking, if I'll be hugely lucky if there's anything there. And there wasn't. I was tramping around on the heath. And then with a lot of cross-referencing of maps, it turned out that it had been demolished in the Edwardian era to make way for the hill garden. And it's just a very beautiful little peaceful, again, free to go to outdoor space. So that one's lovely as well.
Well, fabulous. Thank you so much, Emily. It was a real, real pleasure to have you on the podcast. And can you tell everybody the title of your book and where they can get it?
Yeah, so it's The Fall of the House of Byron. It's nice and dramatic sounding. One day, hopefully, it will be in physical bookshops, but you can find it on Waterstones or Amazon or hive.co.uk as well. It's on there, which would allow you to support a local bookshop. So any of those.
Thank you so much for coming on to Hidden Histories, and I hope that you'll return again soon.